for the month, for the speaker for tonight, I was going to say the month of December, sorry. It's written, I'm just reading what I got here. The speaker for tonight is Chris S. He's from Pottersville, New Jersey, where they don't have any addresses. I'd like to welcome Chris S.
Evening, everybody. My name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
I had a separation experience in or around December 28th, 1989. I was able to drag myself off to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and start on this road to recovery that I'm still on today, and I'm very, very grateful for that. Where it says we don't speak for AA as a whole, I did want to note that I actually do speak for Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob from the grave. So anything I say, you can take as gospel. I am an alcoholic. I'm a bad alcoholic. I'm one of these alcoholics who I'll get a new job because there'll be problems at work and I'll have to find another job, and I'll get a new job and I'll show up there sober for a while, and you'll make the mistake of saying, "Chris, you know, we're going out for drinks after work. You want to come?" And that would be like the biggest mistake you've ever made, because I'll go out and I'll have a few drinks and I'll be like the nicest guy in the world. Then I'll turn into like some kind of psychotic Godzilla. And you'll come up to me the next day at work and you'll be like, "Just stay away from me. You are insane. Stay away from me." I'm the type of alcoholic who once I start drinking, I absolutely lose all control over how much I put in my body, and I drink with a vengeance. And no matter what happens, the most important thing for me is to get more alcohol into my body. I'm the type of alcoholic who destroys the emotional security of anybody that's close to me, anybody that loves me. I'm the type of alcoholic who crashes cars. I come from a period of time when friends did let friends drive drunk, you know, and it was almost an obligation to let friends drive drunk. And we would get drunk, we'd walk to the party, get really drunk, and then go back home and get the keys. I've literally totaled 9 cars in drunken blackouts. I've been thrown out the front window, thrown out the passenger window, and thrown out the back window. The only window I haven't been thrown out is the driver's side. And, you know, there's still time probably for that. But I was actually killed in a car accident, which, because alcoholism is a progressive illness, it always gets worse, it never gets better. It got worse after I got killed, believe it or not. My drinking, at least. But here's what happened. I drove into a telephone pole, and it was in a 1968 Chevy Nova. My head bent the steering wheel down, my chest shoved the steering column into the car, and my knees went through the dashboard. And when the cops got there, I wasn't breathing and I had no pulse. So they had to revive me, and I did the CPR. And then in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, I went flatline again, and I had to be revived again and all that stuff. And I remember waking up in the emergency room, and they're sewing my head shut. You know, I had like everything was messed up, and they're sewing me shut without any anesthesia. Because if you're as drunk as I am, the last thing in the world they're going to do is give you anesthesia. So I wake up, and you know, I'm like puking on the doctor, and he's like sewing my head shut. And I remember just screaming and at him, you know, "Was there anybody in the car?" You know, and he's like, "Shut up!" You know, he's trying to sew me up. He came into the room the next morning after his shift just to talk to me, and he looked at me and he goes, "You know, we here at Morristown Memorial Hospital don't take blood alcohol levels of anybody in critical condition. It's just not our policy. But I want you to know that I was willing to make an exception in your case." You know? I mean, and he looked at me with this look of utter contempt. And I was to see this look of utter contempt on many, many people, you know, in the course of my drinking from that point on. It got to be, you know, it got to be something that I would almost expect from people. But anyway, now if you've just done something that has killed you, you usually would think long and hard about the consequences of doing that thing again, wouldn't you? You know, like if you grabbed a high voltage line or something, you know, and it threw you in the hospital, you would think really well, long and hard about grabbing a high voltage line again, you know. It's like a Pavlovian response that one has when you're killed. What happened with me was the minute I got out of the hospital, the first thing I did was go home, get in my car, drive to the liquor store. You know, my head's bandaged up, my ribs are taped up, and I bought a 12-pack of beer so that I could drive down to the park and drink the beer. And, you know, as people would come into the park, I would tell them the war story, because it was a pretty good war story. You don't get killed every day. So, but think about this. It did not even occur in my consciousness whatsoever to not drink and drive. You know what I said? I said, I am never going to have 13 beers and then smoke two joints on top of it. Ever again. Ever again. It was those two joints, damn it. You know? I mean, like alcoholics are the type of people that, you know, they've gotten their seventh DWI and you know, they're really remorseful and they're walking away and they say to themselves, I have to stop driving, you know? I mean, that's us. It's like it just doesn't even come into your head that the alcohol is the problem. So anyway, you know, I'm this dysfunctional New Jersey suburbanite kid. You know, I grew up in a family. It was like a mother, a father, a little Cape Cod house. You know, the father worked, the mom stayed home. You know, everybody was happy. There was never a harsh word to be heard in the house. It was like this idyllic little life. You know, where the hell did I come from? I remember my earliest recollection of altering my consciousness was, I was about 5-6 years old, and I discovered the can of lawnmower gasoline in the basement. It was an old army can, and you pull the top off, and I would stick my head on this thing, and I would just breathe the gas fumes until I was spinning around. I mean, I don't know if anybody ever did the gas sniffing, but I mean, you lose time. I mean, like time, like, you know, really slow. I remember, you know, going up to my parents and I'm like bouncing off the walls. Oh, what a cute little kid. You know, they had no idea. I'm already getting high. I'm like 5, okay? One of the exercises that I was asked to do, when I was doing a fear inventory, inventories ago was, go to your earliest recollection of specific fears when you're inventorying. When was the first time you remember having this specific fear? And it was fear of people. And I was thinking back and I thought to myself, you know, the first time that I can remember being afraid of people was the day my mother took me off to kindergarten. Okay, she packed me up in the car, she drove me up to this, and I remember her letting me out, and it was a hill, and you go down the hill and then there was the kindergarten. And as I'm standing up there on the hill, I'm standing up there on the hill, and all the kids are playing. They're like laughing and playing kickball and playing tag. They all look like they're having a great time, like they've been friends forever, like everything is fine. I'm standing up there on the top of the hill like a dick, okay? I'm like, what if they don't like me, you know? What if they make fun of me? Well, what if I get ostracized, you know? I mean, I had all this, like, self-centered fear. I gotta tell you right now, a pint of whiskey right then and there, and I would have been okay with the kindergarten stuff. You know what I'm saying? I was definitely born a pint low. I was. I was born a pint low because I had that self-centered fear, that kindergarten angst, you know. I had this stuff going on until I turned 13. And one day I was 13 and I decided with my friends that we were going to cut school, go back to my mother's house and steal a bottle of booze and drink it, because that would be the cool thing to do. And we could then tell everybody about it the next day at school and be heroes. So anyway, I cut school. The two guys, we went back to my house, and I pulled out a bottle of Four Roses whiskey. Okay? I can't even smell Four Roses whiskey. To this day, if you put it underneath my nose, you would be cleaning yourself up. Okay? But here's what I did. The only way I knew how to drink was the old John Wayne movies. You ever see John Wayne? He'd saunter into a bar and he'd go, "Bartender, whiskey." And the bartender would pour out a big glass of whiskey and hand it to him. And, you know, he'd drink the glass and he'd grab the bottle. You know, so I thought, okay, that's how you drink. So I poured these glasses filled with warm Four Roses whiskey and handed them out. Now, the two guys who had the warm Four Roses whiskey that were with me maybe drank half, maybe two-thirds of these glasses of whiskey, and they had had enough. I don't know what they felt because they weren't alcoholic, and I am. I've never had a what you would call a normal reaction to alcohol, so I don't know what happened to them. But I do know that they stopped after about two-thirds of the glass. I drank three glasses of this stuff, and the rest of whatever they had went into a blackout, trashed the house, and woke up in a field with the lost time. You know, like the black, you've had blackouts with the lost time. Have you ever traveled, like in a blackout? You know? Have you ever woke up with like strange people or things? You know, absolutely. Well, I see some people identify. Okay. Well, anyway, there was this big chunk of missing time, and I mean, I was ill. You remember the first time you got drunk? You were just psychotically ill. I mean, you should have been in an emergency room. I mean, I couldn't get off the horizontal plane for like 2 days. I'm like, oh. And I'll tell you what. You know, if you were a normal person and you ever ate or drank anything that would make you feel as ill as I was, you would think long and hard about eating or drinking something that has made you feel that ill, wouldn't you? Well, absolutely. Like if you ate a strawberry and you ended up in the hospital with like convulsions and projectile vomiting, you probably would, you know, steer clear of the strawberries, wouldn't you? Well, that's not what happened to me with alcohol, because something else happened when I drank the alcohol. You know that scared kindergartner? You know, the self-centered fear, they're not fitting in, they're always feeling less than, they're feeling like you're on the wrong planet. Well, as soon as I started drinking this alcohol, all that stuff disappeared. All the fear was gone. I had no more fear. I felt like I thought everybody else felt normally. You know, because they all look fine. So I finally felt fine about some things, about myself. And I was like the funniest guy. I was larger than life. I wasn't afraid to say anything to anybody. You know, I didn't have any worries about anything. And slowly the memory of being incredibly ill started to fade. And that memory of feeling okay with the world, finally comfortable with myself and my environment, that stuck with me. And alcohol started to be a preoccupation. And what I mean by that is, I said to myself, no more Four Roses whiskey, but let's start working with this stuff. Because this stuff, there's some potential in this stuff. You know what I mean? You figure out how to work this right and you'll be okay. So I started to think about what I was going to drink, when I was going to drink, who was going to buy it, because I'm 13 and the drinking age is 21. Some logistical difficulties there, nothing that couldn't be overcome. About, you know, who was going to buy, you know, where we were going to do it. I started to become preoccupied with all this stuff. And I come from a very smart family. I have a brother and a sister who were both college professor PhDs. My mother and father were both Phi Beta Kappa, you know, educators, you know, just huge, massive amounts of overeducated people in my that really know very little about practically, but I won't go there. Anyway, just like, you know, incredible amounts of potential in my family. Has anybody ever told you have potential? Yeah. All right. Until they finally stopped telling you, you know, because they finally realized they could have been wrong. But anyway, I'm in high school, and did I say to myself, Chris, you're becoming preoccupied with alcohol, and oh my goodness, your grades are slipping. You know, you better take a look at this because you got to pull your academics back up. Did I say that? No, I couldn't have cared less. I couldn't have cared less. All I cared about after a while was drinking and where I was going to do it. And anything in the way of that was lame. And I was certainly not a lame person. So I became preoccupied with alcohol, and it started to inundate my life. Along about being a senior in high school, I met this wonderful codependent. I didn't even have to take her hostage. I mean, she willingly came along, you know. And she was great. She came from an alcoholic family, so being around me was like home sweet home, you know. It was like, the drama of home. And she would pick up the pieces of all the wreckage and make excuses for me. And she was well trained, and she was like a ninja in that stuff. And it really worked well. So I hooked up with her, and I convinced her that to stay with me, you know, would be the ultimate bliss that she could ever experience. And she did. She hooked up with me. About a year out of high school, I took the year off after high school, you know, I was going to say to find myself, but I couldn't find anything at that period of time. I wasn't even looking, you know. I was just, but I took a year off, and I recognized the fact that the people I used to party with are doing things like they're getting jobs, they're going to college, they're calming down. You know, unbelievable. And my party base is shrinking. And it got down to the point, actually, where the people that I was partying with didn't even have names. They were like Bear Man and Weezer, you know, and they all had their own parole officers, but I'm jumping ahead. I'm wondering where everything is, and I should probably do something, you know. So I get on the phone with a buddy of mine, and he's going to the University of South Florida down in Tampa, Florida. And I go, how do you like it down there? And he goes, dude, there's like a bar in every building, and drugs. This is where they all come into the country. I'm like signing up the next day. I don't even know what the school has, you know. I don't even know what majors it has. I'm signed up. And I moved down there. I moved down to Tampa, Florida. That was rough. I start going to school, and anybody in here a good starter? You know what I mean? Like out of the starting gate, then everybody tastes your smoke. But by like lap two, it's like you've changed your mind about whatever the hell you're doing, you know, and you know, it's not as important anymore. Well, that's the way I was. And I remember starting out with like 14 credits, you know, Economics 3, Business Law, you know, Statistics, Appreciating Music and Swimming. And after a while, I'd start dropping these like five course ball breakers, and I ended up with like Appreciating Music, and that was this class where all you had to do was show up and listen to the guy play his Beethoven sonatas, and you got like credit, right? So I couldn't even do that right. I'd bring in a six pack of beer because sitting like 2 hours like listening to somebody play music was too much. So he'd be in the middle of this like real impassioned solo, and you'd hear, you know, and he'd be like looking around, and everybody'd be looking around like, you heathen, what is the matter with you? And so I ended up going down there and going to college for 3.5 years and getting 4 credits. You know, that's like a record, you know what I mean? And so those are my days of higher education. The codependent that I brought with me, because I talked her into coming to Florida, because, you know, where else would you be but with me? She comes down to Florida, and in a drunken blackout, at least this is what she said, in a drunken blackout after a fight we had, I proposed to her. At least that's what she said. And I wake up the next morning, and the invitations are being printed. I swear to God, the invitations, and her parents know, and her cousins and uncles and sisters and brothers and dogs, they all know. And I thought to myself, my God, what a scene it would be for me to back out right now. Oh, well, you know, it's way in the future anyway. Okay, what the hell? And so I went through with this whole thing. And I actually got married. And she'll never let me forget this. The night of our wedding at the party after the reception, the only woman in the whole room that I didn't molest was her. You know? So it started off really great, you know? And, oh, God. Man, would you get your husband off of me, please? Oh, it's just beautiful. So I don't know how this happened, but this happened. But well, I do know. She's Catholic, okay? The best codependents are. Anyway, she's Catholic. And being Catholic, 9 months to the day you could have set your watch to it, I had a daughter. And 9 months to the day after we were married. And, you know, the crazy thing was she wanted some things that I just found them to be just too much. She wanted me to come home at night. She wanted insurance on the car. She wanted me to give up hanging out with Weezer. I remember this one time, I learned a big lesson. I got thrown in jail for drunk and disorderly or something. You know, when you meet somebody in jail, don't tell them to stay in touch. Okay? I made that mistake this one time, and this guy came over to the house. Oh, jeez, I don't even want to go. But another time I was taking a left across traffic. It was like a road like Route 22 or, I don't know, you probably Route 1 down here. And you have to wait at the light until there's no traffic coming, and then you can turn left and cut across. Well, people on lewds should not drive, okay? I'm doing whiskey and Quaaludes, which if there are some newcomers in the room, we don't recommend that, by the way. Don't drive if you're doing those. I misjudged the velocity of one of these cars somehow. I don't know how. And he T-boned me and rolled me down the road about five times. Just I remember knowing it was a serious accident because here's an important warning sign. Your shoes come off. Okay? If you've ever been in a car accident and your shoes are off, important warning sign. It's a bad one. Okay? So I've got glass in my head. I remember like coming to, laying on the roof of this car because it's upside down and people looking like this. Is he dead? Is he dead? I remember crawling out of the car realizing I don't have my shoes, much to my chagrin, crawling back in the car. I mean, I'm to get my shoes because I'm not going to be seen in socks, for God's sake. So I'm sitting here covered with blood. The police come up and they say, you know, when we get you back to the hospital, we're going to take a blood test from you because we think you're impaired. Okay, whatever. They take me back and they roll me into the emergency room on a gurney. And I look around and I'm unattended. You know? They roll me. So I go, I'm getting the hell out of here. So I jump off the gurney. I bust through the doors, run through the waiting room like 100 miles out. People are like, like this because I'm covered with blood, the glass sticking out of my head. I go running out into the parking lot, and I'm heading for the woods because I don't want a DUI or whatever they give you down there. I know it's bad luck. So I'm running like crazy, and in drives my wife, who I had given like a bystander her phone number to tell her, you know, to come meet me at the hospital. I've just had an accident in her car. So here she comes with her sister and her sister's boyfriend, and I dive through the window onto their lap, saying, "Get me the hell out of here! They want my blood!" Like this, right? So they're like horrified. They're like, "What are you talking about?" You know, but anyway, I'm very persuasive sometimes. I talk them into getting me out of there and taking me back to the party that I was at. And back at this party, I had a couple of biker women yank the glass out of my head. You know, that they were trained in first aid techniques like that. You know, so it was cool. They got the pliers, you know, like, yeah, oh, here's a big one, yank, you know. And they got all the glass out of my head. And meanwhile, the cops are trying to find me, obviously, so they're back at the house. my wife can't take this anymore. I mean, even codependents have a breaking point. And she decided that she'd had enough, and she packed up the car that we had left. She emptied the bank account, took my daughter and took my dog, for God's sake, and moved back to New Jersey. And I just continued drinking down there for quite a while. Alcoholism is a progressive malady. What you can always guarantee is, over any given considerable period of time, it's going to get worse. It's not going to get better. I ended up doing what a lot of the macho guys that come into AA do when your scorecard kind of reads zero and you need to take a little bit of a geographic. I moved home with Mom, and I was thinking to myself, you know. She's been there by herself all this time, you know, and she probably could use some help around the house. So I moved back in with Mom for like 7 years, you know, the last part of my drinking. And, it was awful. It got worse. I started to do things that, again, there's some newcomers in here, so make sure that you understand this is not a recommendation. But I was trying to control my alcohol consumption with heroin. It actually worked a little bit. It's just I could never really balance, you know, the quantity. And I'll tell you this one story about how it didn't work. I had been doing the whiskey and heroin Jimi Hendrix thing this one night, and I got up in the morning, and I was an electrician by this time. Okay, it wasn't my fault. I got sober, and I was an electrician, and there was no real reason. I was not a good electrician, by the way. I used to get electrocuted about once a day. But anyway, here I am. I'm 32 years old, and the guy running the crew is 19. I mean, that's how much faith this particular electrician had in me. But anyway, I'm doing the heroin whiskey thing. If you've ever done that, you're very thirsty the next morning. As a matter of fact, you're dehydrated like a sumbitch. And I remember buying a half a gallon of grape drink on the way into work that morning, and I drank practically the whole thing down. Now, I'm working with this guy who's not real happy with me. He really thinks I'm lame, and I'm always ill, and I just don't pull my weight. And all of a sudden, I feel like this, right? And I know from past experience I have about between 13 and 21 seconds before I'm going to have to vomit. So I think to myself, I got to think quick. I don't want this guy to see me vomiting. So I know what I'll do. I'll pretend I have to go around the back of the house. And I head around the back of the house, and I get around the back. I fly around the back of the house, and whoa! I stucco the backside of this house with purple vomit, just all over this house. And I look over to my right, and not 10 feet away is a deck. And on this deck is a family. It's a mother, a father, and three kids. Now, I knew they were related because of the expression on their face. It was the exact same expression. It was like this. Yeah, I mean, can you imagine? Talking about domestic disturbance. Anyway, this is the kind of stuff that's happening in my life. And I'm wondering where all the chicks are, you know? Where are all the babes? And I'm like hollering and puking is the best I can do socially. Anyway, this one day, I'm trying to put a ground screw in an outlet box, and I just can't do it. I can't do it. I'm shaking too bad because by this time my alcoholism had gotten so bad that when I'd wake up in the morning, I would literally be detoxing, and I would be, you know, I'm sure most people in here have felt it. I mean, it's, you can call it anxiety, you can call it whatever the hell you want. It's detoxing, okay? That's what it is. Every morning, and I can't even operate a screwdriver, okay? Now, you gotta understand, I've lost my family, I've lost my driver's license. At that point in time, I was thinking that when I get my license back, there'll be Jetson mobiles, for Christ's sake, you know? I had three DWIs, you know, All my friends are gone. I'm ill every day. The thing of most value in my entire life is a comic book collection. I mean, I'm really down the tubes. And, but not being able to put the screw in the outlet box is what put me over the edge, because the 19-year-old kid gave me a look just like that doctor in the hospital many years back, that look of like, you pathetic. You are just so pathetic, you shouldn't even be alive. I knew he was thinking that, because when you're detoxing, you can hear people think. It's about the only time that it really works. But I could hear him. He was thinking at me, and that's exactly what he was thinking. So anyway, I couldn't take that. I couldn't take it. So I signed myself into a rehab, which was, I called them up. I said, I'm coming in. They're like, well, who are you, first of all? And anyway, I go into, I go in and I do the 28-day thing in the rehab, and I got the $13,000 big book and the pat on the butt to AA, which was helpful. But it did separate me from alcohol for a period of time, and for that I am grateful. Anyway, I get out of rehab. You gotta understand something here. Being alcoholic, I so wanted to separate from alcohol by the time I signed myself into rehab, because number one, I hated crowds. Number two, I hated being told what to do. Number three, I hated not having freedom. Number four, God forbid I had to make my own bed. You know, all these things that the rehab was going to make me do, I wanted no part of it. And God, I just really want to sit in your circle and share. I really do. I really want to be open and honest with all of you new friends. Oh, boy, I just can't wait. I'll fucking kill all of you, you know? And if this one crazy counselor comes up to me, and I'm like, my head is about to explode about some issue, you know? And she's like, well, Chris, tell me, are you happy, mad, sad, or glad? I almost ripped her throat right out of her neck. I couldn't believe somebody would ask me something like that, you know? I'm an alcoholic. What do you mean, what do I feel? I feel like every feeling put into a blender and turned on 10. That's what I feel. How am I supposed to pick them out? And, you know, good God. So anyway, I got out of there, but I really wanted to stay away from booze. Now, they said go to AA and go and come back here to outpatient. And I got to tell you, that was a blast. $35 a session to listen to some muttonhead, you know, talk 20 minutes about some crap with his girlfriend while I'm paying $35 an hour. And well, shut the hell up. I got crap I want to talk about, you know. And that's about what outpatient was like. It was so much fun. The AA meetings, I mean, I was going to 2 AA meetings a week, for God's sake. What do you people want? You know how hard it is for me just to do this? And so I really thought I was treating my alcoholism. I'm going to the outpatient, $35 a week, and I'm going to 2 AA meetings. And one day, on the way to an AA meeting, the thought crossed my mind that I hadn't had a drink in, oh man, it must have been almost 3 months now. As a matter of fact, I don't even remember what it's like to be drunk. I don't even remember. How can I do this sobriety thing without remembering what it's like to be drunk? And you know, this AA stuff, they're saying get a spot, do all this stuff, and I'm not doing it. I know what I'll do. I'll buy a gallon of vodka, I'll drink that gallon of vodka, and it'll make me feel so bad that number one, it'll take care of forgetting what it's like to be drunk. I'll know right away what it's like to be drunk. And number two, I'll rush back to AA and start doing the things that they're asking you to do. Yeah. I didn't have a sponsor, by the way, because I know if I would have ran that by the sponsor, they probably would have said, well, I've got a different plan for you, you know? But that, you know, the newcomer plans, me and my buddy collect and trade them, you know, the newcomer plans. We've got a great collection of them. They're the best. Anyway, so this is what I did. I drank the gallon of vodka. And here's what happened. I started drinking that vodka, and about 2 glasses into it, you know, when the alcohol starts getting into the bloodstream and your whole perception starts to change, and all of a sudden, you know, you start to feel that booze coursing through. I said, oh my God, what have I done? I've woken up the beast. You know, the beast is going to run me around like a puppet for who knows how long. And that's exactly what happened. I knew that once I started drinking, who knows what was going to happen. Now, the insanity preceded the drink. The drink actually restored me to a little bit of sanity. That insane, that strange mental blank spot that preceded the first drink, the not really being able to fully explain my reasons for allowing myself to go back out in any sane or logical way, that pins me down as an alcoholic. The thing that really identifies an alcoholic the most is really seriously making an attempt to separate from alcohol and not being able to. And that's what happened in May. A wonderful 6 months ensued, whereby the culminating event of it all was, I'm still at mom's, by the way, it's Christmas 1989, and my brother's coming home, my sister's coming home, nieces, nephews, cats, everybody is coming home for Christmas. And I start drinking, I think it was Johnny Walker Black, you know, that was my holiday alcohol. I started drinking that, and I went into a violent episode. I mean, I went into this blackout. It was like a multi-day blackout, but I was just completely insane, whereby I threatened my entire family. I was going to kill every single one of them. Now, yeah, that wasn't the festive type of mood they were looking for, obviously, you know, over Christmas. So they took their Christmas elsewhere, thank you. And they went to my sister's house, and they left me to drink my, literally, this is what they said, to drink myself to death at the house. That's what they fully expected to happen. Anyway, I come to, and there's a pile of vodka bottles in the sink about this high. I mean, I didn't even remember buying them. I must have been a real sight staggering up to the liquor store, you know, about every 2 hours for another bottle. And I started going into some really, really violent DTs, the kind where you see demons and there's maggots on the couch and there's little animals running around. What was that? You know, and you hear bands playing, you know, and there's shit scratching to get in. You know, whenever I'm sitting with a newcomer and, you know, they'll see a fly go by or something, I'll go, I saw it too. Yeah. It's okay. Yeah. Cause I know exactly what that's like. So anyway, that was fun. That was 2 days of just real fun, let me tell you. I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to watch upside down. I go, I've been talking for 7 hours? I know, it was fun, but anyway. I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I made it back there. And by this time, I had gotten my license back by some fluke. Actually, I need to tell this story. I'm getting my license back for a third DWI, okay? And has anybody here had to deal with motor vehicle? Oh, wonderful, wonderful, fun stuff, isn't it? Good God. That's usually your first resentment in early recovery is motor vehicle. Anyway, I finally have everything. I tried every means possible to get it back dishonestly. I finally had to do everything they asked me to do. And I show up at Wayne, New Jersey, and I, you know, but here's what happened. First of all, I don't do well with motor vehicle and crowds and lines. Alright? I need, you know, a couple of pops to be able to feel comfortable about all that shit. Alright? Cause I just don't like it. So I had a couple of drinks before, and I drove down to get my license back for a third DWI. And I'm throwing this stuff down on the desk, and I got this, and I got this, and I got this, and I got this. Now give me the paper, because she had to give me a paper whereby I could go downstairs, and they would have to give me a license. And she goes, she starts to sniff me. She starts going, she goes, you smell like vodka. Have you been drinking? You know, she couldn't believe it. It's like 9 in the morning. I'm getting my license back for a DWI, and I've been drinking vodka. I'm like, you know, the regular alcoholic answer, right? No! I haven't been drinking. No! And so she's handing me this piece of paper because she's got to give it to me, right? But And she hands it to me, and I take it. I'm trying to pull it, and I'm trying to find it. She won't let it go. She's like, won't let that paper. She's like, thinking society is going to be harmed or something. You know, I just can't do this. You know? But she finally gets me the paper. You know, I get my license thing, and I go circle through the woods and stuff in case she's looking out the window. So anyway, I get my license back. But the car that I buy, I bought it from Inflato Man. He's a friend of mine, and he sold me. That was his name. He sold me a 1976 Ford Granada with white walls. Okay, and I thought it was cool. Okay, and all the quarter panels were gone. You turn on the heater. There's no heater core, so it would squirt antifreeze on the inside of the window. There was no muffler. There was no emergency brake, and there was no clutch. Hardly at all. You could barely get the thing going. So the first meeting I got to, I needed to go to after I got detoxed, it had to be flat to get there. There couldn't be any hills in between me and the meeting. So I went to Mars. I remember pulling up in front of the church, and everybody, you know, 400 people, there was probably 20, but there was like 400 people were standing outside smoking cigarettes, and I had to drive up this little incline to get into the parking lot. And it's kind of, so I'm going, whoa! And the car's going about a mile and a half an hour. I felt like such an asshole. You know, I'm going, they're going to think I'm late. So I had to park the car against a tree. Because there was no emergency brake, no clutch. It would have rolled, you know, so I put it up against a tree. It's very funny that no one parked in the spaces next to it, yet there was a full parking lot. Anyway, I went into the meeting. And I'll never forget, I read it as a beginner's meeting, but for some reason my perspective was skewed that day. And it was a 12-and-12 meeting, and it was actually a meeting on the 12th step. And I sat down, and somebody handed me a step book, and I'm figuring it out. They're going down the line like this, and they're about to get to me, and I'm going to have to read a paragraph. I'm going to have to read a paragraph out of this book. I can't even hold this book. I got to get the hell out of here. So I did. I got the hell out of there, and I'm standing outside on the porch. Just, it was one of those defining moments. I was like, "Can I do this? Can I do this? I don't even know if I can do this." And I'm having a cigarette, and this guy called Jorge came outside. And he started talking to me. I thought this guy was like God. Afterward, he had like 8 days. But anyway, you know. So if you have like 8 days, you know, you're doing all right. Anyway. He came out and he goes, "So what's your deal?" I said, "I realized it was terrible. I was just drinking. I was trying to get out. I'm sober." And he goes, "Well, why don't you come on back into the meeting and sit down?" And I'm like, "Well, you know, there's a meeting tomorrow. In the best reason, I'm going to probably go to that meeting tomorrow because there's people I know. And, you know, I'll go home tonight and I'll go tomorrow." He goes, "No, come on back into the meeting." So he drags me back into the meeting. And he sits me down in like the second row. And by this time they'd finished reading and now they're sharing. So I'm sitting there and he goes, "Raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back." And I'm like, "Well, it's the beginning of the meeting tomorrow. It's the meeting tomorrow. You always raise your hand and tell everybody I'm coming back tomorrow." He goes, "Raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back." Now everybody starts looking at us because he's getting loud. I'm like, "Oh my God, they're looking at me. They'll be thinking about me next, you know?" So I go, "I got to do something." So I raise my hand right in the middle of somebody sharing. I raise my hand. And the person up front looks like this. Goes, "Oh, hold on a minute. Yes, go ahead." And they call on me. I said, "Oh, I'm an alcoholic. I'm out there relapsing. I'm drinking. I'm just back in AA." And everybody's, "Yay!" And they start clapping. And I got to tell you, right at that moment, there was a wall of fear that was keeping me from coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't do it. I was so afraid of what you thought about me. I couldn't do it. I couldn't get through that wall of fear. As soon as I raised my hand and everybody clapped, that wall fell down. And you know what? That's the first time in many, many a year I felt a little bit of hope inside. And from that moment until now, it's been an uninterrupted chain of years of sobriety that I'm very, very grateful for. During the late 80s and early 90s in my area, there was what I would term oral tradition AA. I don't mean anything disparaging about that. What I mean is that the wisdom teachings were passed down through sponsors. Like, my sponsor, Harry Gerbilfeather, said, and you should do that because it was good enough for him. And this is how all the wisdom teachings came down. And some of the stuff was good and some of it was not so good. Some of it worked and some of it didn't work. But that's how AA was in my area. Now, I'm what's known as a real alcoholic. I'm a textbook variety. If you look at the descriptions of the alcoholic in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you look in the chapter to wives, the four stages of alcoholism, I'm in between a three and a four, heavily into the four side. I am a textbook case of an alcoholic. I lack the power of choice in drink. What was happening was, I was involved like crazy in the fellowship. I was going to upwards of 13 meetings a week for a couple of years. I was hanging out with my sponsor a lot. I was going to the diners. I was a secretary here. I was a coffee maker there. You know, I would drive the nuts from the booby hatch to meetings here. And I mean, I did like everything you could do. And you know what? That scared kindergartner, he was still in me. All right, I was doing all the fellowship stuff that you were asking me to do in the North Jersey area meetings, and I still felt terrible. One of the big slogans at that time was "Act as if." All right, I would never ever use that with a newcomer today. I just wouldn't, because it was my experience that acting as if near killed me. Because if you came up to me and you said, "Chris, how you doing?" I would say, "Great." Okay, I was acting as if everything was great. I wouldn't say, well, you know, I have feelings of lack of self-esteem to the point of, you know, suicidal fantasies whereby I want to kill you and everybody else. I wouldn't say that, you know. I would say, great. All right, now, that was acting as if. Well, here I am, I'm doing everything you can possibly do in AA, except I didn't have a program. Now, I didn't know that. They used to call a program, "How you doing with your program? You going to meetings?" You know, I mean, that, well, I guess I'm doing pretty good with my program because I'm going to a lot of meetings. That's just the way it was in my area. This guy, Radio Shack Mike, another one of my buddies, threw me a set of tapes this one day. And it was a couple of tapes by a guy named Joe and Charlie from Arkansas. And I started listening to these tapes. And basically what these tapes said was, "Chris, if you're not working with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're not going through that book and doing everything it's telling you to do, you don't have an AA program at all, because that's what an AA program is. If you're not working out of the big book, you don't have an AA program, so don't say that you do." And this didn't really go over well with me, because I thought I was getting A's in AA. I was doing more than everybody else, and, you know, I've got those alcoholic feelings that could be hurt. So anyway, I threw the tapes off to the side, and I didn't bother with them. But I'll tell you what, the truth haunts. When you know it's the truth, first it'll piss you off, and you'll get a big-time resentment, but it'll haunt you, and you'll think about it. And that's what I did. I started to think, you know, they're right. There's spiritual recovery. You know, there's not just sobriety, there's recovery. And the difference between sobriety and recovery is like the difference between night and day. It's like, sobriety is, "I'm just not drinking today." And recovery is, "Man, life is great. I love every bit of life." You know, that's the difference between sobriety and recovery. So I pulled out these set of tapes. I opened up the big book and I started working through the exercises and the four steps and all that stuff. Another thing I started to do was, believe it or not, by that time, I was sponsoring some people, and even being as ill as I was sponsoring some people, because sometimes the tugboat with the most steam pulls the boats, you know what I'm saying? So some of them are actually even still alive. I don't know how that is, but I was sponsoring some people, and there were some of them that weren't able to get sober. They were the type of people that people would say, "You're just not being honest. You know, you're not honest, or you must really not want it, or you must want to drink more than you want to stay sober. I mean, that's what these people were getting at this point in time. And I knew that they were like me. They did. They wanted to separate from alcohol in the biggest way. They just couldn't do it. Something was going on in their mind that didn't let them. And I started bringing them over to my house, and we started going through the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, page by page, sentence by sentence, instruction by instruction. As soon as we got to an instruction, we would stop, and we would do it, and then we would move on. And I found out something very, very significant in this period of time. Number one is the people that did that, that went through the book, Alcoholics Anonymous with me, they're still in AA, every single one of them. They're members in good standing, and their quality of life is superb. The people who wouldn't do that, some of them are still around, you know, mediocre recovery. So a lot of them are gone. I don't know whether they're drinking or they're just gone. But I learned something. I learned something very, very significant. If you want to really increase the likelihood of you being here 5 years from now with an even better life than you have today, your chances are a hell of a lot better if you work the steps. And I learned that firsthand and with my experience working with others. Over the course of the years, I had a lot of experiences in AA. I started working with a lot of people. There's a couple of things that I've done. I started a meeting in Bernardsville. I'll tell the story of that meeting. Over at my house, I had a meeting on Thursday night whereby I would invite people over, and people would go through the steps in my house. Sometimes just one person, sometimes six, seven people. But this one individual who was relapsing over and over over the years was in a bad way. And he comes over to my house and starts working with me. He got permission from his sponsor. And he got up to amends. He had 93 amends. He did 90 some of them. And I mean, by the time you've done that many amends, there's something going on with you. You know, you know what I mean. If you've seen people like that, or that's your experience. And his sponsor came up to me and said, "What the hell did you do with that guy? Whatever you did with him, I want you to do it with me. Can I come over and go through the steps with you?" I said, "Sure." So he comes over and he goes through the steps. He had been sober 12 years. Never gotten his license back, terrible relationships, terrible jobs, terrible stuff always happening to him. He goes through the steps with me, starts his own business, gets his license back because he's making amends, gets a fiance, gets married, buys a house, all in a short period of time. And his priest goes, "What the hell happened to you?" And he goes, "Well, I was going through the steps with this guy named Chris." And he goes, "Where is he?" And he goes, "Well, I hear he's speaking in NetCong in a couple of days." He goes, "I'm coming with you." He comes up to NetCong. He shows up at this meeting. He listens to me speak. He comes up after the meeting and he goes, "Listen, whatever the hell you're doing in your house, I don't even need to know, but I want you to do it at my church. You can have any room, any night, whatever. It has to be part of our church's mission. I don't want any money, whatever." Now, this was kind of significant because this particular meeting is a presentation meeting. In other words, God forbid we actually teach at this meeting. We teach you how to go through the steps. God forbid, because there are no teachers in AA. All the teachers get drunk. You know what I mean? Bullshit. Anyway, not that I judge. Anyway, we start a presentation meeting where I read out of the big book and show people how to take the exercises that are talked about in the book. Now, I never, ever would have done that without a priest being involved, because how egotistical would something like that be? You know what I mean? "Well, I hear Chris started a meeting and he's telling everybody how to be sober." I mean, I just wouldn't have done it. But because of the way these events laid out, I knew that I just had to. It fell into place so well. So anyway, that meeting has done quite well over the years. A lot of people have gone through it. A lot of people have benefited greatly from some of the things that have been done there. Mike and a number of other people have participated in that meeting. And some of the other things that have happened, when I first got sober, I was a terrible electrician. I now am a general manager of a facilities account with over 70 employees that report directly to me, and about $8 million in budget that's put right in my lap. You know, I'm to run. You wouldn't have put a lemonade stand in my lap back when I was drinking. You would have worried about me ruining that. I actually drive late model vehicles, even manufactured during my current period of sobriety. For you newcomers, you'll get there. You'll get there. Hang in there. That's a guidepost when you start buying vehicles that were made while you were sober. Instead of being the last owner of everything you have. If I could say, because there are some newcomers in here, let me tell you two things about yourself. Number one, you don't know how much trouble you're in. You are minimizing. If you are less than 90 days, you are minimizing. It's part of the illness. You see the scratches of alcoholism, but the claw marks go very, very deep. You can't see that. You are in way much more trouble than you think you are. Okay? Alcoholism affects every aspect of your life. If you're depressed, if you're having problems with personal relationships, if you feel anxious or restless or irritable or discontented or not comfortable with yourself, guess what? That's alcoholism. That's alcoholism. The drinking is just a symptom. Okay, so alcoholism has its grips on you a lot more than you think. Here's the good news. The thing that is true that you don't believe right now, if you're under 90 days, is there's more significant answers in Alcoholics Anonymous and 12-step recovery for all of your life issues than you believe right now. Every single quality of life issue that you have can be so benefited by consistent meeting attendance, working the 12 steps with an experienced sponsor, and then being of service, finding ways to be of service. So if you are new, please believe that and keep coming. Thanks for letting me share here.